Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
From the Missouri School of Journalism, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm David Reed. Today is World Press Freedom Day. In 1993, the annual celebration began with a proclamation by the United Nations General Assembly. Today we'll evaluate press freedoms from a broad perspective, and we'll take a close look at two regions where the most dramatic progress took place in the past 12 months, the Middle East and North Africa. At the same time, there have been significant setbacks to free expression and worrisome developments in the Middle East. Our guests today are high-level advocates who will be they're both speaking from New York. Jennifer Dunham is the research analyst for Freedom of the Press at Freedom House. Mohammed Abdel Dayem is from the Committee to Protect Journalists, CPJ, where he is the Middle East and North Africa Program Coordinator. Jennifer and Mohammed, welcome to Global Journalist.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Now the UN's education branch is hosting celebrations around the globe and today and this weekend, and the main gathering is being held in Tunisia, the genesis of what became known as Arab Spring. UNESCO said the recent uprisings in some Arab states highlighted the human quest for freedom of expression and, quote, has given rise to an unprecedented level of media freedom. But the Freedom House annual report on press freedom throws some cold water on that feverish depiction. Jennifer, as the co-author of the report, can you give us the broad picture of press freedoms in the past 12 months?
Sure. The main finding of our report was definitely the improvements that we saw in several countries in the Middle East and North Africa, mainly Egypt, Libya, and Tunisia, where longtime dictators were removed after several successful popular uprisings. And while the positive trends in these countries were not uniformly positive, and we saw important setbacks into the democratic prospects in both Libya and Egypt towards the year's end, in our survey, we saw huge improvements, especially in Libya and Tunisia, that represented major breakthroughs in a region that has a long history of media control by autocratic leaders. And the gains in these two countries, along with the gains in Burma, I have to say, were also dramatic. Were among the biggest single-year leaps of in any country in the history of our survey. I should also say that there were significant declines in other Middle Eastern countries, such as Bahrain and Syria. Although these declines reflected the regime's violent reaction to tenacious protest movements whose demands for greater freedom included calls for a more open media environment. So, one note of caution with the new media, the role of new media in these openings. You know, the role of new media and citizen journalism made major contributions, especially in Egypt and in Tunisian uprisings. And they're crucial to the creation of a new democratic political dynamic. But when you see the, especially in Egypt and to a lesser extent in Tunisia, when they're trying to establish democratic systems, you know, the new media can be effective in disseminating news of government abuses and mobilizing civic action against these illiberal regimes. They seem to play a much less significant role in the construction of democratic institutions, you know, especially in these societies where much of the population still gets its information from state-controlled outlets.
Yeah.
So, you don't see the leaders of especially in Egypt, the leaders of the protest movement really having control of the government right now. So I think that's an important thing to watch out for.
Okay. Now, we'll get more into the report, but I want to have Mohammed respond to a couple of the subjects you brought up. One is the violent reaction, the deaths of at least 20 protesters in Egypt this week reminds us of the passions and the high stakes involved with free speech and challenges to the power structure. How does violence and the threat of violence affect free speech, particularly in the Middle East and North Africa?
Well, of course, it's a form of intimidation, and it is sometimes exercised purely so that it will intimidate mainstream journalists as well as new media practitioners, intimidate them into silence. However, I'd like to point out something equally important. That's the fact that when you do have a robust new media, as you see in the Middle East, especially in places like Egypt right now, they are frequently the ones breaking the news from demonstrations, as we have seen in the past days with these dozen-plus people that were killed in clashes in Cairo. It is frequently the bloggers, the citizen journalists, who are breaking the news, is that television and print media and more traditional forms of media who do a lot of the follow-up, much of which is much more in-depth and much more professional in nature. But the point remains that a lot of these stories are broken by bloggers and new media in general, and they also provide traditional media with political cover. Traditional media is able to handle some of these topics that they may not be able to cover appropriately if it weren't for bloggers breaking the ice, so to speak.
Do you also agree with Jennifer or disagree about the role of new media after after the revolution, that it plays a smaller role in helping to establish the mechanics of a working democracy?
Yeah, I mean, the nature of the work is slightly different with bloggers and new media. Primarily, they don't have the infrastructure and the support mechanisms that a big media organization provides them. That's a drawback. The advantage is they're also not bound by many of the rules and regulations that you see in mainstream media. And as a result, frequently see them covering things that mainstream media can't. We saw this in the 18 Days of Revolution in Egypt, for example. It was very easy for the government to go to a specific news bureau and shut it down or confiscate equipment. The government was not able, as we witnessed, to clear, say, Tahrir Square of the tens of thousands of people who had video cameras on them and who were reporting the news after traditional media was sidelined to a large degree. So it's not a question of new media versus traditional media. It's really more how new media has filled some of the gaps created or left behind by traditional media when governments try to restrict their work.
Right. I thought it was interesting in your article on CPJ, for CPJ, called From Arab Uprisings, Five Trends to Watch. You quoted a former Yemen bureau chief for Al Jazeera who said, quote, "This is an instance where revolutionary technological changes enabled actual revolutions." Do you think that, with satellite technology now getting better, that the trends are going to be even more ability to have free expression through Twitter and text messaging?
I think all these new technologies are really a continuation of something we saw in the Middle East about 15 or 16 years ago with an explosion of satellite news coverage and the emergence of Al Jazeera, Al Arabiya, and then dozens upon dozens of other news channels. In the past few years, we saw the explosion of Internet penetration throughout the Middle East and North Africa, and the popularity of social media and of blogging and all those things. And then we really saw these things being put into practice in Tunisia, and then in Egypt, and then in Libya. And then we saw those things spread like mushrooms, frankly, to Bahrain, to Syria. And in Syria, you have an uprising that is well into its second year now. And for extended periods of time, virtually the only reporting that is available is actually reporting by citizen journalists inside Syria as the Syrian regime in Damascus continues to obstruct the work of professional Syrian journalists, as well as prevent foreign journalists from entering the country.
Right. The let me get back to Jennifer for just a bit about the, and we'll talk a bit more about the report and the press index. It was a bit counterintuitive, I thought, Jennifer, in your findings this year, that the percentage of the global population that enjoys a free press has fallen to its lowest level in a decade.
Mm-hmm.
That seems counterintuitive. Can you explain why?
Well, we have three categories in our rankings: free, partly free, and not free. So the improvements that we saw in the Middle East were mainly countries moving from the not free to partly free category.
Mm-hmm.
The countries that are in the free category, which this year fell to percentage of the world's population, is only 14.5%, which is a decline from last year, was mainly due to status declines to partly free.
Mm-hmm.
In several well-established democracies, notably Chile and Hungary.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of a, excuse me, a continuation of a trend that we've seen in the past few years, where we've seen declines in other democracies, such as South Korea, Italy, South Africa, all moving into the partly free category. And
mm-hmm.
that's something that we're definitely keeping an eye on as the governments there. It's hard to make generalizations about what exactly those governments are doing. Obviously, Italy has its own characteristics. And but this year, Chile, we saw they had their own kind of version of the Occupy
mm-hmm.
Movement with this student protests and the education protests there. And you saw a lot of crackdowns and violence against journalists who were trying to cover the protests.
Right.
And in Hungary, you saw they declined significantly last year. And then in this year's report, they moved to partly free just due to concerted efforts by the conservative government of Prime Minister Orban to seize control of the legal and regulatory framework for the media. So I think that's, it's just something that we need to watch out for.
Right. Now, the U.S. score even went down a bit. Can you explain why that was?
The U.S. score, mainly that was partly due to the 1 point decline for the U.S. was due to its own problems and the difficulties encountered by journalists while covering protests associated with the Occupy movement. Detentions, rough tactics by the police,
mm-hmm.
things like that. I know some other press freedom indexes, such as RSF, downgraded the U.S. by a lot more for that for those incidents. But
and also, doesn't the economics also play a role?
Yeah, the economics plays a role in kind of keeping the U.S. from being one of the world's in the world's best performers. Places like Norway and Sweden and Finland, which are the highest ranked in our index. This is the general poor economic conditions for the news industry, which contribute to a lack of diversity
mm-hmm.
in the media environment. That's been a trend, kind of a downward trend for the past maybe 10 years, I think.
Right.
More of a concentration of ownership that I think, we're all aware of in the United States. But we did downgrade the U.S. by 1 point, just mainly due to the problems with the Occupy.
Okay. Before we continue our discussion, I also want to get back to Mohammed about the the newspaper industry and how it's different in the Middle East now. I want to remind everyone that you can view or listen to this program anytime by downloading our podcasts at globaljournalist.org. You can also find interesting articles and photos and interviews related to our program on our website. Excuse me. Please send us questions or comments via globaljournalist@kbia.org or our Facebook page. You can also follow us on Twitter at GJJournalist. Now, the newspaper industry is having trouble here and across much of the world, in Tunisia and Egypt and Libya, there's been somewhat of a resurgence. Can you talk about the media landscape there?
Sure. Many of the economic problems that you see print media going through in this country and in Western Europe are actually duplicated in the Middle East. But at the same time, there's a new dynamic taking place with an opening up politically and with a widening of the margin for free expression. You also see new publications coming to the forefront. Really, the most extreme or the most obvious example of that is Libya, which was a country that had virtually no free press for well over 40 years. And in a few months after the end of the uprising, we saw something like 100-plus print publications and over 30 radio stations and TV outlets springing up. Now, this is obviously the direct result of a lack of private media in a place like Libya beforehand. So curiously enough, in these countries, you actually see both dynamics taking place, the economic imperatives and the economic pressures that we see in a place like the United States are very much taking place. But there's also this other dynamic that is the result of an opening up of the political space.
Okay. Now,
if I could just make one comment on that, not to sound negative, I was speaking to our Libya analyst, the person who wrote our Libya report for this year, and she was commenting that she was back in Libya recently, and just that while there were so many more print outlets, she was just commenting that it was kind of a free for all. Kind of a lack of professionalism, lack of self-regulation due to the lack of regulatory structure that exists because the government is still kind of finding its feet. And it's, there's not the regulatory structure in place, and there's not really even a journalist organization yet to kind of put in place self-regulation because there's no tradition of that in Libya yet. So we kind of have to be cautious about celebrating.
Yeah, and we sort of saw this at the end of the Cold War, where Russia and a lot of these countries had freer speech shortly after the revolution, and then when they now it's dwindled somewhat. And what do you think about that, Mohammed? About the kind of the saw a documentary about the revolution called Half Revolution, and he named it that because they considered the revolution to only be halfway over, partly over, because there could be setbacks and to the democratic process and to free speech. What are your thoughts about this ebb and flow?
Well,
are you positive?
When we talk about regulators and regulatory structures and the existence of government bodies or government-sanctioned bodies to regulate the media in the Middle East, we have to remember that in principle this is a good idea. You do, in fact, need a body that will regulate who broadcasts on what frequency, and perhaps another body for print media that will determine some regulatory matters related to advertising and distribution and things of that nature. However, we have to remember that the regulators and the regulatory structures that existed in those countries prior to the uprisings were anything but regulatory. They were, in fact, structures set up explicitly to censor, intimidate, and otherwise repress free reporting. And
right.
So the absence of those structures in a place like Libya, for example, is actually a positive thing. That's not to say that new structures and new regulatory measures should not be established. They should, in fact, be established in order to regulate, not to duplicate what we had in the Gaddafi days, where there were plenty of regulatory structures, but they were in fact used quite openly to censor and intimidate. So regulation is usually a good thing. However, the devil is in the details, and how these regulatory structures actually end up operating, that's really the big question.
Right, and you could also talk about self-regulation by the journalists themselves. If they do set up some kind of code of conduct or something like that, that could be positive as well. I just don't think that exists in Libya yet either.
No, and then you're absolutely correct. It doesn't exist. But I am, in general, always wary until I see the actual text.
Right.
Because if we look at a place like Iraq, for instance, it was precisely those kinds of things, the code of ethics and new regulations regarding who may and may not join the journalist syndicate, for instance, that ended up being politicized and ended up being used, as we see happening in Iraq today.
Mm-hmm.
They're being used to actually hamstring independent media or to punish journalists who take the current government to task for corruption or any number of other issues of public interest.
Well, let me. We have about 2 minutes left, so let's just get back to a few of the areas we haven't really touched on. And speaking of the new regulations in China, they just instituted some new regulations on microblogging. Jennifer, China is of course a tough nut, and but have these regulations or will microblogging continue to help free expression grow in China?
Well, as far as I can tell, the regulations haven't really been put in place effectively from the last time I checked. I think the bloggers have either found ways to get around them, or the blogs were saying that they were going to implement them, but they haven't mm-hmm. actually been implemented. That's the last I checked on the subject. But, I mean, you do see constantly in China government's attempts to impose these restrictions,
okay.
and then a pushback by citizen journalists and netizens to test the limits of permissible expression.
Okay. Sorry, Jennifer, we've come to the end of this.
Next
editions of Global Journalist. Sorry to cut you off there.
That's all right.
The program is produced by the Reynolds Journalism Institute and the Missouri School of Journalism. Joining us today was Freedom House's Jennifer Dunham and Mohammed Abdel Dayem from CPJ. Global Journalist is directed by Travis McMillan, audio by Pat Akers. Raymond Tungakar is our executive producer. Now stay with us for a special expanded edition of Free Press Watch. And join us again next week for another Global Journalist. I'm David Reed.
And now, Free Press Watch, a segment on Global Journalist where each week we bring you a rundown of major events affecting press freedom around the world. I'm Lainey Mullen. In celebration of World Press Freedom Day, we're focusing today on a couple of advancements made in press freedom this year. Our news comes from the Center for International Media Assistance, the Knight Foundation for Journalism in the Americas, the Mail and Guardian, and Nieman Foundation for Journalism. A libel case against Political and Investigative Weekly in South Africa led to a landmark decision to support press freedoms in the country. The Mail and Guardian has been writing investigative stories in Johannesburg since the height of apartheid oppression in 1985. Since that time, it has also staved off its fair share of lawsuits. In 2009, Audrey Besson wrote a series about the dealings between a facilities company and privatized sectors of the prison industry. His work drew threats and eventually a lawsuit. But last week, the judge denied a request that he be forced to reveal his sources. This sets a precedent for future protection of journalist sources in the country. We spoke earlier with Nick Dawes, Besson's editor at the Mail and Guardian, about what it has been like to report with these continued legal challenges.
The Mail and Guardian, because of the nature of our journalism, because it's tough journalism, because we tell stories that people don't want told, spends a great deal of time fending off attempts to shut us up, unfortunately. Some of those attempts are fairly basic intimidation. A lot of them are attempts to use the law to quiet us, either by intimidating us with costs or by tying us up in court processes. So we've been accused of all sorts of things, ranging from obtaining information illegally to defamation and other crimes. And what that does is that it ties up a huge amount of our energy that should be spent on doing great journalism and money that should be spent on doing great journalism in fighting these sorts of battles. Unfortunately, it also means because we suspect that we're under a good deal of surveillance, that we aren't able to have the kind of free conversations among ourselves and with our sources that we would like to have. So that's very, very frustrating. But at the same time, the result of a lot of these challenges has been that we have been able to establish very important legal precedents that support press freedom. So almost all of these legal attempts, in fact, all of them on my watch, have failed. And in the process, the constitutional protection that's afforded to press freedom has constantly been reasserted. So the harassment for us is difficult, it's frustrating, but in general, we've been able to win out because of the independence of the courts.
Dawes spoke about the implications of press freedom changes in South Africa for all of Africa.
South Africa is seen by many people as a kind of beacon of press freedom on the African continent. And democracy arrived in South Africa at a time when there was growing democratic energy across Africa. To the extent that there are threats to press freedom in South Africa, they don't only affect me and my colleagues in this country and the quality of democracy in South Africa. They really do have an effect on the whole continent. And, of course, the success of the democratic project in Africa is important to the whole world. The troubles that Africa faces are really, I think, a stain on the conscience of the whole world. So I hope that our friends and colleagues around the world will pay attention to what is happening here and indeed to what's happening to countries to our north where the situation is a great deal worse. And we'll see that we're all linked across borders in the challenge of upholding and defending press freedom.
In Brazil, the government has approved a law allowing regular citizens access to public information. Starting May 13, anyone will be able to get documents from city, state, and national governments and private groups that are getting public funding. Two journalists working with O Estado in São Paulo set up a blog to educate people on what they can do with the new law. We spoke with Roberto Gallo, one of the blog writers.
We're about to change from a culture of secrecy to a culture of transparency. Although it's going to take a while, it's not going to be immediate because Brazil has been handling a culture of secrecy since the country was discovered. But you can see the government making lots of efforts in order to change that. So I think that's the main point. And when people have information empowers people. That's what I think it's going to be the most important part. It's going to change the relation between society and government. This is what I think is going to be the most important part.
Journalists in Brazil still face troubles and the danger of violence in the country, but strides have been made toward press freedom in the last year since President Dilma Rousseff has been in office. People are increasingly using social media to fight corruption, and their efforts, along with the work of investigative journalists, have led to the firing of 5 ministers for corruption. For more information on these and other events affecting press freedom around the world, please visit our website at globaljournalist.org. Thank you for joining us this week on Global Journalist. I'm Lainey Mullen. See you next week.